The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
And then there was one. With Santorum suspending his nomination bid, Romney can focus more fully on Obama. But what about dubious conservatives and women?
Showdown, how tactics Obama adopted to counter conservatives in Congress may play out in the presidential race.
The MPG debate, what today's high gas prices mean for tomorrow's higher miles per gallon standards and what they may mean for car makers, buyers, and drivers.
How Cook cooks, Broadway and cabaret legend Barbara Cook on approaching new songs at age 84.
What Mike meant, the impact on TV news as we know it of 60 Minute star Mike Wallace, dead last week at age 93.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of Gatewave.org, the nonprofit 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of April 15th, 100 years since the Titanic tragedy, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
We made a decision over the weekend that while this presidential race for us is over, for me, and we will suspend our campaign effective today, we are not done fighting.
He will continue to have a major role in the Republican Party, and I look forward to his work in helping assure victories for Republicans across the country.
I was disappointed in listening to the president as he's saying, oh, Republicans are waging a war on women. The real war on women is being waged by the president's failed economic policies.
And then there was one, or one and two halves, or two quarters, confronting a daughter's illness and increasing signs of his own weakness in home state Pennsylvania. Rick Santorum last week left the race for the Republican presidential nomination. That left Mitt Romney with a likely lock on the necessary convention votes and subsiding sideline action by Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul. But Romney continued to face major problems, exciting the conservative GOP base, while reaching the other way to close wide gaps with women and Hispanics.
And Romney's basic reputation for financial savvy and administrative competence took a hit at the weekend when it was announced he needed an extension on paying income taxes, something you would think a multimillionaire presidential contender would have experts taken care of on time, unless there's more he wants to hide until just before the November vote. To consider this and other factors affecting the latest shape of the presidential race, we're joined again by TV commentator Eleanor Clift, also a contributor at NewsweekDailyBeast.com. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you.
Some Republicans presumed that the long primary campaign would strengthen Romney as a candidate or at least make his weaknesses old news, but the polling has not shown that.
No, I think the primary race has really taken a toll on Romney and hurt the Republican Party as a brand. Romney is facing a huge gender gap that he has to somewhat close with the president, and he's still facing a rearguard action by Newt Gingrich, who is still in the race and saying that he's there basically to monitor Romney and make sure he doesn't move too quickly to the center. And he's going to do everything he can to make Romney adhere to the most conservative positions that he took during the primaries.
The latest polling also gives Obama a 4-point lead nationwide. On the other hand, you've noted that Romney is in better shape than Bill Clinton in 92 or Ronald Reagan in 1980. Remind us about Clinton.
Yeah, I think we forget that other nominees have faced big challenges. When Bill Clinton wrapped up the nomination in June of 92, he was running third in the polls behind then-President Bush and Ross Perot, the billionaire Texan who had entered the race. And within the campaign, they had set up something they call the Manhattan Project to basically do a remake of Clinton's image, and that led to the movie The Man from Hope, which was shown at the convention, which allowed voters to look at Clinton in a different light as somebody who had overcome great odds to get where he was.
Some say Romney's shifting positions in the past may help him now, suggesting he won't really stick to all his conservative primary positions. What's your view?
The conventional wisdom is that if you're in the Republican Party, you run to the right in the primaries, and then you move to the center for the general election. I think the Obama campaign is going to try to prevent Romney from doing that, at least doing it easily, and Gingrich also is in the race. But because Romney has such a shifting persona, I think most moderate voters think he's really one of them, and conservatives are really suspicious of him. And so I think that could help him moving into the general election because he does not seem like a threatening figure or someone who is beyond the pale when it comes to his ideology. And there have even been polls out suggesting that most voters see Obama as a center-left by not that much, and most voters see Romney as center-right by not that much, which sets up a very competitive election.
What about the shadow on his competence of filing for an extension on his taxes on the very day President Obama releases his returns for this year and the last 11? Is this a hint of something to hide beyond the fact that Romney's rich, or does it humanize him?
Well, I think it would only humanize him among people in the top 1%, where it's pretty routine to ask for an extension because you've got these complicated finances. And I think the specter that the Obama people are trying to raise is that, you know, the Romney is busy, you know, sheltering his income here, there, and everywhere. So I think this is a problem for Romney, and I think delaying it just heightens interest. And he may still have a Swiss bank account, and so these are triggers that get into the whole issue of tax fairness in the country, and that Obama campaign really hopes to frame the election around that.
Well, Romney got an unexpected helping hand on his problem with women when Democratic strategist Hillary Rosen mocked his reliance on advice from his wife, who Rosen said, quote, hasn't worked a day in her life. And even President Obama agreed it was the wrong thing to say about a mother of five, a grandmother of 16. How do you see it affecting the politics of what both sides now call the other's war on women?
Well, it tells you that the vote of women in this country is going to be fiercely fought over. Women are 53% of the electorate. And that comment by Hillary Rosen touched a nerve among many women. It was once called the mommy wars. And it's this tension between women who choose to stay at home and women who choose to go to work. And then there are women who really don't have much of a choice and have to do both whether they want to or not. And each camp feels like the other camp disrespects them. And so she left out the key phrase that Ann Romney had not worked a day of her life outside the home in a traditional job. If she had said that, I think it would not have been nearly as inflammatory. But the Romney campaign jumped on it, as well they should. But I think the Democrats are still going to play to women who are looking around the country at all the Republican-led legislatures and states who are passing lots of laws that are restricting reproductive rights.
One way Romney could trump women's complaints about conservative policies on contraception, abortion, would be to name a female running mate. How likely is that after the GOP's Sarah Palin experience?
Extremely unlikely, because if you look at the Republican side, the women who might be chosen, like Susana Martinez, Hispanic governor, has not been in elective office very long, is pretty much an unknown quantity. And women who have been in the political process longer, like Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison in Texas, or Olympia Snow or Susan Collins, don't fit either the demographics or the ideology of today's Republican Party. And I think the experience with Palin really makes not only the Republican Party, but all politicians wary of taking a newcomer on board without doing a full vetting. So I think the likelihood of a female on the Republican ticket is really quite remote.
So who do you see as some leading contenders for the second spot?
Well, there's a lot of talk about Florida Senator Marco Rubio. In part, he's young, he's dynamic. He also happens to be Hispanic. But he hasn't got a long record of being vetted either, and there are probably some question marks. And I think the conventional wisdom now seems to be shifting to Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, who's been around a long time. He was President George W. Bush's budget director, presiding over a time when budgets weren't exactly balanced, which you would think would be a negative. But Portman has won statewide in Ohio, and if he could carry Ohio for the Republicans, that would be a significant asset.
TV commentator Eleanor Clift also writes for NewsweekDailyBeast.com. Her books include War Without Bloodshed, The Art of Politics, and Madam President, Shattering the Last Glass Ceiling.
Quote from the news, simply to show that they can. That was an Obama official suggesting that last week's failed North Korean missile launch, ostensibly to put a satellite in orbit, might prompt another Pyongyang nuclear test to overshadow the embarrassment.
Next, Inside the Obama Game Plan, for your ears only. We'll be right back. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. We do not prosecute by public pressure or by petition. That was Florida State Attorney Angela Corey on finally bringing charges for second-degree murder against George Zimmerman for gunning down unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin, though protests online and around the country clearly helped put the case in her lap. And her filing followed the Martin family's contention that Trayvon was trying to run away when confronted by Zimmerman, potentially undermining his use of the stand your ground defense. In Tulsa, police quickly arrested two white men for shooting five African Americans, killing three with racial motivation. Now this.
The Buffett rule is something that will get us moving in the right direction towards fairness, towards economic growth. It'll help us close our deficit, and it's a lot more specific than anything that the other side has proposed so far.
If the objective here is to create more jobs in this country, make it easier for small businesses to compete, to put more money in people's pockets, to make people have more work instead of less work, this is the last thing that we want to do.
Even the Obama campaign has to admit that raising tax rates for the richest Americans by itself will have little effect on the deficit or the economy, as Republicans like National Committee Chairman Rins Priebus complain. But fairness is a flexible and useful political position, and the president continued to play it on the campaign trail last week before leaving for a hemispheric summit in Cartagena, Colombia. That was only slightly shaken by two small bomb blasts there and another near the U.S. Embassy in Bogota.
The shape and prospects of Obama's reelection strategy have grown in large part from an evolving game plan for dealing with growing conservative power in Congress, exposing social priorities on spending cuts and contraception, for example, that have even some Republicans worried about mainstream voter backlash. That game plan is analyzed in the new book Showdown, the inside story of how Obama fought back against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party from William Morrow Publishers. The author is David Korn, Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine, and he joins us now for Your Ears Only. Welcome to our program.
Great to be with you.
You write about Obama's evolution from compromise to confrontation with congressional Republicans. Was it a case of realizing Plan A had failed, or was it always his game plan to look reasonable first, then turn tough for his reelection year?
Kind of both. I hate to sound like a politician here. The book is an inside the White House narrative of what went on after the mid-2010 elections that were a disaster for the Democrats, with the House Republicans and their Tea Party wing taking control. And compromise at first worked very well for the president. If you remember the lame duck session, he got a tax cut deal that got him a lot of criticism from his colleagues on the left, but did get him a second stimulus that he couldn't otherwise have gotten past Senate control by the Democrats, but there were a lot of Republican filibusters. So he ended up getting the second stimulus that the House Democrats couldn't pass on their own because he was willing to compromise on those Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. So that was a compromise, say, of choice. Then he turned into 2011, and the president comes up against the full Tea Party Republican Party in the House on two important issues, the budget and the debt ceiling. In those instances, the president felt, and his people around him felt too, that they were in a hostage situation, negotiating with hostage takers who were willing to see the government shut down or a financial crisis occur, which the president and his top economic advisors believed in each instance could lead to a double-dip recession. So there they felt their hands were tied, and they had to try to achieve a compromise to keep the government from shutting down and to avert a financial disaster. We can talk about this later, but people can judge for themselves whether the outcome of those negotiations were good, bad, or indifferent from each side's perspective. But the president felt he had no choice but to negotiate with the Tea Party and John Boehner. After the debt ceiling crisis, two things happened. The president had tried to negotiate with Boehner a grand bargain, deficit reduction plan that would have entitlement reductions that the president's own party wouldn't like, but also revenue increases that the Republicans wouldn't like. But he came to the conclusion that John Boehner, while he might have been sincere in trying to cut this great compromise, couldn't bring his own troops to the table. He couldn't get his own House Republicans to back him. And in fact, I go into this in great length at the book. There are times when Eric Cantor and others are suggesting there might be a mutiny against John Boehner if he proceeds with a compromise with the president. So when that all fell apart, the president realized that he couldn't really come up with any good policy outcomes with attempted compromises with John Boehner.
But also, he was no longer in a hostage situation. He had gotten the government to continue on with the budget, and he had gotten past the debt ceiling crisis. So he was now freer to be more hardcore, hard-edged politically, and more confrontational with the Republicans. And you saw that with his jobs bill and the fight over the payroll tax cut at the end of last year, which he won. And this was all done purposefully to set up a very strong contrast with Republicans and visions and values as sort of as a way to tee up the 2012 reelection campaign.
You talk about how he took some criticism for not quickly producing his own deficit reduction plan, not immediately challenging House GOP cuts, letting the conservative priorities become quite manifest. I'm wondering if there was a similar trap in mind when the administration rolled out its rule requiring that even religious-related employers provide contraceptive care insurance, which pulled a lot of Republicans into what we're now calling this apparent war on women.
Your supposition of your question is correct. The White House, at the beginning of 2011, did not engage the Republicans right off the bat in terms of their budget cuts or produce a major deficit plan because they wanted the Republicans to go first. They wanted to set up this strong contrast, and the president had calculated correctly that if the Republicans had enough rope, they might hang themselves. So they produced the Ryan budget last year, and a new version came out a couple of weeks ago, more or less the same, which ended the Medicare guarantee and put the Republicans, I think, on the defensive, as I think they are now, and allowed the president to make the case. Listen, they want to just cut, including throwing kids out of Head Start, cutting back Pell Grants for college, not invest in research and infrastructure, all the things I want to do. And you can see it plainly in their budget. And after that budget came out, and they want to give tax breaks to the wealthy as well, after all that came out, he was unable to sort of use it as a contrast with his own plan, which had deficit reduction, but also these investments in the future. Thought it was a very smart, I think in retrospect, a very clever strategy that at the time, looked like he was sort of dodging the hard questions and he had to take a lot of criticism for that. Regarding the war on women, I'm not sure they were as clever this time around with the contraception rule that, brought, the Republicans or, drove them to the extreme right, in which they would have a hearing on contraception policy in the House before a Republican-controlled committee without a single female testifier, witness. And all this talk about contraception and greater abortion constraints that are or restraints, have, I think, really driven, women away from the Republican Party. It's offended independents. It's put Republicans in a box. The president, I know this directly, after the 2010 elections, thought that the Republicans would go too far and they couldn't help themselves in some of these social issues and expected that would help them down the road. But I'm not sure the decision on the contraception was as clever a jujitsu move as you make it out to be.
David Korn is Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine. His new book is Showdown, the inside story of how Obama fought back against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party from William Morrow.
Quote from the news, a rare moment of calm on the ground. That was former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan, gratified by the initial days during which Syria seemed to comply with his ceasefire proposal, but warning against provocation by armed opposition forces.
Next, the miles per gallon debate for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. There were a lot of questions and a lot of tears. That was an attendee at the funeral of Neil Haywood, an English businessman whose death in a Beijing hotel room is now under investigation as murder, for which one suspect is the wife of a controversial Quanqing party leader and Politburo member, now suspended, raising questions of corruption and division at the highest levels of China's leadership. Now this.
It really all depends on what crude oil prices do next. If they stay where they are, and they're down about $3.50 in the past 2 weeks, that is per barrel, then the price may already have peaked.
Yeah. As oil industry analyst Trilby Lundberg noted to the Associated Press last week, gas prices may finally have maxed out. Still, Americans are increasingly taking note of fuel efficiency in today's new vehicles, albeit with considerable caution when it comes to actually purchasing electric cars like the Fisker Karma, so quiet it needs a soundtrack to alert pedestrians, as we heard at the giant New York Auto Show last week.
And automakers are working to meet pending higher federal fuel economy benchmarks, 35.5 miles per gallon by the year 2016, 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025, as passed by Congress and signed by Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, a point worth noting in this gas price-sensitive election year. But are the companies working fast enough? And will new autos meet those stricter standards at prices car buyers can afford, with profits that keep car companies in the black? Joining us to consider those questions for Your Ears Only is Professor Walter McManus, an auto sales and profits expert at the Oakland University School of Business Administration in Rochester, Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, David.
In the past, some automakers fought higher mileage standards by saying they would be bad for business. But you co-authored a new study actually projecting higher profits despite the increased cost of fuel efficiency, and especially for domestic automakers. First, do you think most car companies will meet these new standards?
Yes. The Detroit and the Asian automakers have always met standards in the past, and they will certainly continue to do so. In the past, some European companies have paid fines in lieu of meeting the standard, but now that the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, is also involved in it, the ability to get out of the standards with fines is very limited. And there are waivers and credits, however, but I believe that they'll all comply as necessary.
And what do you project as the cost to companies to meet those standards?
Well, we're projecting that by 2020, which our study focused on 2020, which is partway, $600 per car on average, more for cars, less for trucks, actually.
And what sort of profits do you project compared with those now coming back after the big financial crisis?
We project that in 2020, the industry will see a boost in profit of about $5 billion.
And you find that domestic companies will do better than the Japanese, Germans, or Koreans?
Yes. We find that of that, a little over half will be earned by the Detroit Three, and the rest by the Asians and Europeans.
And certainly in the election season, jobs are going to be a main issue. Will this mean more employment for U.S. auto workers or more robotics on the assembly line?
Well, it should increase employment, certainly should spur that. In the rest of the world, they want fuel efficiency and have always wanted it. And finally, Detroit manufacturing and American manufacturing will be globally competitive.
The National Automobile Dealers Association is not so supportive of the new standards, saying higher prices will leave millions of potential new car buyers on the sidelines, which could undermine your projection of company profits. Why do you think they see things so differently?
Well, they have a claim that I think is really doesn't make sense in their filings. They say that the impact of the standards are going to be very limited because the automakers are the focus of the standards. And according to NADA, the automakers don't care if the dealers can sell them. I mean, this makes no sense. The auto companies, of course, care about whether they can sell them. And in fact, their testimony before the EPA and the Department of Transportation, they said, we believe we can sell these to consumers. Also, NADA claims has sort of a strange claim about the assumption of regulations affecting innovation. They say that these are "quote unquote" push standards, and that it's equivalent to saying if they build them, they will come, sort of wish fulfillment. But in fact, there's a lot of evidence that innovation can be induced by regulations as well as by consumers. And there are international spillovers that you won't have. The SUV, for example, no international spillovers. Nobody else wants them.
Well, speaking of consumers, how much money do you see the new miles per gallon standards saving drivers of economy standard luxury cars and SUVs on a weekly, monthly, or annual basis?
Well, on an annual basis, we're probably talking about $3,000 on average across all the vehicles. SUVs will save the most, quite a bit more. Luxury, next, standard cars, and then finally the economy cars.
I gather the boon you see for car makers and car buyers in the new mileage standards may not apply to cars that reach those benchmarks with electric power. A New York Times analysis 2 weeks ago indicated it could take years of lower fuel expenses to make up the higher cost of an electric car versus those that rely simply on more fuel-efficient gasoline engines. Talk about that.
Well, the electric vehicles and hybrids and plug-in hybrids, they're all electrified. Those vehicles today represent a very small share of the market, and they will continue to represent a very small part of the market in 2025, even though they will be dramatically increased, doubled or tripled by then. But they still will be a small part of the market. They'll need them to meet the standards, but they won't be a big part of the market. They're going to do lots of things with gasoline engine improvement and with stop-start and some other technologies that they can put across the whole fleet. That's what they have to do to really make a standard.
Professor Walter McManus is an auto sales and profits expert at the Oakland University School of Business Administration in Rochester, Michigan.
Quote from the news, so dollar wasteful that it serves no effective purpose. That was Donald Heller, drafter of a 1978 California death penalty expansion, now urging its removal. In Connecticut, meanwhile, the governor was poised to sign a repeal of that state's death penalty, making it the fifth state in 5 years to abolish capital punishment and the 17th state to have none.
Next, an old pro tries some new music for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. It's the web fairy tale that all startups dream of. That was Forrester research analyst Melissa Parrish on the $1 billion purchase by Facebook of Instagram, the mobile photo sharing site that allows users to take photos, alter them, and share them with friends. Now this.
There were bells on the hill, but I never heard.
Some of us remember Barbara Cook as the enchanting librarian Marion in The Music Man on Broadway in 1957, or in Leonard Bernstein's Candide, or the musical She Loves Me. There were many more roles than years of personal problems before Cook reemerged in the mid-1970s as a universally acclaimed concert and cabaret performer, singing show tunes and standards by Gershwin, Rogers, Sondheim, and the like. So I thought this interview would be about how Cook keeps old material fresh. But because her new show at Feinstein's Club in New York's Loews Regency Hotel features mainly songs she's always wanted to sing but hadn't, for your ears only, Barbara Cook joins us now to talk about how an old pro approaches new material. Ms. Cook, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thanks. Very nice to talk to you.
I suppose my first question has to be, what kept you from singing these songs before? Who said no, or why didn't they seem right before this?
Well, nobody said no, but I am a soprano. And I do think when you sing certain songs, you have to be very careful. You have to choose carefully, because I certainly don't want to sound like a soprano who's trying to do swing or trying to sing jazz, you know. I think the reason I was able to do this is that as I get older, I get more and more courage. And I think, well, you know, let's try this damn thing, see if it works, and people seem to think it's working. In fact, a lot of people think this is the best cabaret show I've ever done, which makes me feel good.
Well, these songs may have been new for you, but they're hardly unknown by Harold Arlen, Hoagy Carmichael, the Gershwins, John Lennon. So how do you make them your own, sort of create your own interpretation?
Well, I think it's the way I approach everything else. I try to bring my life experience to it and filter it through what is left of my brain. That's about it, I guess.
Do you sample other versions on vinyl, CD, or YouTube, if only to avoid similarity with those who've done them before?
Well, you know, I do sometimes listen to how other people have done these songs. For one thing, to see, you know, it's always difficult to end songs. And it's always a good idea to see how other people have solved certain problems in doing any song. So I do listen to other people in that sense, but I certainly, you know, I don't in any sense try to imitate their way of singing the song, not at all.
They always ask songwriters which comes first, the words or the music. Lyricist Sammy Kahn famously said the phone call, as in Sinatra Wants a Christmas Song. But what attracts you first or foremost, a song's meaning or its melody?
You know, it varies. Sometimes I hear a really beautiful melody, and I think, oh, I'd like to do that. And then when I investigate what it says something I don't want to sing. You know, there's a gorgeous song called Vincent about Vincent van Gogh. Do you know that song, Vincent?
Yeah, Don McLean?
Yeah, Don McLean's
right.
Song. And in there he talks about the reason van Gogh killed himself is because the world is such a terrible place. Now, that melody is so beautiful, and I'm seduced by that melody all the time. And then when I listen to the words, I can't sing that because I don't think the world is a terrible place. So I just, you know, it's a beautiful, beautiful song, but I just disagree so much with what it says that I've decided to never sing it.
Let's talk about songs you chose for the current show at Feinstein's. All of them about love. One celebrates love of home, Hoagy Carmichael's Georgia on My Mind, but you admitted to the audience that for you it's kind of a lie, despite the fact that you were born there.
Talk about that. I was really ready to get out of Georgia. I didn't belong there. And that's a simple truth. I belonged up here, and I knew that. And I knew at the moment I arrived in New York, and I knew that I would never, never go back home because I don't belong there. I just don't belong there. I always felt like I was on the outside of life looking in when I was a kid in Georgia, you know, for a lot of reasons, not just Georgia. And, you know, those pine trees depress the hell out of me if I'm there for a few days. I don't have any reason to go back recently, but, you know, it's just, I don't belong there. It's clear and simple to me.
You say in the show you haven't sung a lot of Porter, and you chose Let's Do It, one of his particularly tricky list songs. Explain what they are and why they can be so difficult.
Well, because there's no through storyline to help you to get to the next phrase. It's just a list of things of one sort or another coming right after the other, and that they are notoriously difficult to remember everyone.
Do you listen much to your own recordings?
Occasionally I do, particularly if somebody says, oh, I'd like the way you did blah, 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 whatever it is, and I'll go back and say, oh, what did they like, and to see what they liked. I do that sometimes.
So what kind of music and whose do you listen to for pure pleasure?
Well, it's hard. I don't just sort of listen to music as I'm doing things because it interferes with my doing things. I know a lot of people when in their office when they're typing or doing something have music playing. I can't do that because my ear is so drawn to the music that I can't concentrate on the other things I'm trying to do. And the other thing I've found, and I love opera, I'm more likely to listen to that than anything. And I found that I enjoy watching it being sung as much as anything else. So I listen to DVDs a lot more than I just play music, you know?
Barbara Cook's new show is Let's Fall in Love at Feinstein's Cabaret in New York's Loews Regency Hotel, another triumph predicted by one of the songs she's done often before.
It's not where you start, it's where you finish.
Quote from the news, "This is the biggest mistake I've made in my life so far." That was Miami Marlins manager Ozzie Guillen on earlier admiration for the leadership longevity of Cuban dictator Fidel Castro, which outraged Cuban-American fans the Marlins have been trying to attract.
Next, what Mike Wallace meant to TV news. For your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. "Everyone wants to punish him because he's a crappy human being. But in America, we prosecute conduct, not character." That was Melanie Sloan of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington as jury selection began in the trial of John Edwards for corruption and alleged improper use of campaign funds to cover up his adultery and illegitimate child. Now this.
He was doing what?
With you.
Why?
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 I mean, you're a crook. Doggone, I wish they didn't say that, though.
I'm nosy and insistent.
When Mike Wallace was asking, the questions were often more interesting, dramatic, traumatic than the replies, as evidenced in that audio montage by CBS News after Wallace died last week at age 93. Sometimes the questions came in ambush interviews, sometimes with a hidden camera, all techniques that have now become standard in television news, for better and worse. Some saw Wallace as the founder and face of investigative broadcast journalism, while others saw at least as much actoring and ego.
To talk more about Wallace and his legacy for your ears only, we're joined again by his former colleague Gary Paul Gates, author of Airtime, the Inside Story of CBS News from HarperCollins in 1978, and co-author of the Wallace memoir Close Encounters from William Morrow in 1984. Welcome back to our program.
A pleasure to be here, David.
Wallace did some acting in his early years, and I often sensed he was, more than other 60 Minutes correspondents, playing himself as much as reporting. Would he admit that?
Oh, he not only would admit it, I think he'd kind of wear it as a badge of honor. He believed quite strongly that part of being a strong broadcast journalist has to be a bit of a performance. And I remember, I forget who it was now, but it was somebody, it might have been Osgood or John Hart or someone like that, once telling me that when they had substituted for, I guess, Cronkite on the evening news, Wallace called him afterwards, "Come up here, I want to talk to you." And he said, "You know, you sat there, you look like you're waiting to be executed." And he said, "You've got to really sort of take command in that situation. You won't hear Dick Salant say this or Walter himself say it or anything, but you have to be a bit of a performer if you want to succeed as an anchor or, I think, as any kind of on-air reporter."
He was, even according to some adoring colleagues, also a bit of a thief, stealing other people's story ideas and subjects if he got wind of them. To what degree did that kind of egotism disrupt the show?
He would probably plead guilty to being called a gonif, but I'm not sure if would have thief. Yeah, well, they've kind of made much of that. There were a couple of times when he really did tick off, I think, Morley on one occasion, and I think Morley on both occasions. But much of that was good-natured, because the blue sheets system of 60 Minutes meant that the producer who was in first with the idea got the story. So if Wallace wanted to kind of horn in, it would be, unless he drugged Hewitt or something, he wouldn't get away with it.
Did he acknowledge all the groundwork that the little-known CBS producers and reporters did to prepare for his famous on-camera interviews?
Oh, yes. He was more generous about that, David, than a great many of the on-air people. In fact, he and Harry, when 60 Minutes went on the air, if you may recall, it originally was Mike Wallace and Harry Reasoner. They were the ones that pushed very hard for the producers to get credit, on screen. Now, that hardly compared to being, you know, doing a star turn. But at that time, no one else in television news was even acknowledging the producers as much as that.
What did he think were his great accomplishments as an interviewer or reporter?
Most of us have a kind of built-in system of, well, there are things we just won't say or ask, I mean, because it's rude. Mike didn't have much of that, off camera as well as on. I mean, he was about as direct a person as I've ever known. That's not to say he wasn't a good guy. I regarded him as a dear and caring friend. But he never hesitated to let you know what he thought, and even if it involved being sort of excessively critical to who he was talking to, he would. So that gave him a leg up on, I mean, a lot of people just would not ask the kind of questions he did. I don't think anybody else in all of television would have been over there in Tehran and said to the Ayatollah, Khomeini, quoting Sadat as saying that you're a lunatic.
Walter Cronkite once told us he despaired of what TV journalism was becoming. Too much theater, too much hair, too little news. How did Mike Wallace see the direction his profession was taking, and what did he see as his own imprint there, for better or worse?
Mike had a slightly more guarded view. He said he shared much of that, by the way. I mean, that it was going in too much of a schlocky direction. But as soon as he would say something like that, he said, you know, I want to be careful here, because what happens is the older generation always gets into that, you know, that whole thing about, boy, those were the good old days and weren't we better. And I'm not sure I trust that. And he said, you know, we'll see. And one of the things that a lot of people have been surprised by, including me, it was a kind of conventional wisdom that once Mike Wallace and Don Hewitt left 60 Minutes, the program was going to disintegrate and fall apart. Well, quite the contrary. I think it's as strong as it's been in some time. I think Jeff Fager has filled Hewitt's shoes marvelously, and the cast of correspondents they have now is also very strong.
Gary Paul Gates, a colleague of Mike Wallace, is the author of Airtime, the Inside Story of CBS News, and a co-author of the Wallace memoir, Close Encounters. But Wallace gets the last word.
Astonishing what you learn and feel and see along the way. That's why a reporter's job, as you know, is such a joy.
And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. What would I have done? That was David Lyle of the National Geographic Channels on the question that keeps people fascinated by the sinking of the Titanic 100 years ago this weekend.
For Your Ears Only on Air is online at iTunes, YouTube, and FeedBurner.com. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please email davidearsonly@gmail.com to pledge.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly at Playa Productions with interns Daniela Quintanilla and Kaimana Larson. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern, with support from the nonprofit Gatewave.org Radio Reading Service, Carnegie Corporation of New York, Nathan Cummings Foundation, and the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Kaimana Larson. This week, following the death of Mike Wallace, we dig back further to remember that even more iconic star of CBS News, American television and journalism generally, Walter Cronkite. From our July 19, 2009 and December 8, 1996 broadcast, hosted by David, Catherine, and Warren Levinson of Associated Press.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
When Walter Cronkite broke the news of President John Kennedy's assassination, he was already well on his way to becoming the most trusted man in America. From Vietnam to Watergate, from political conventions to outer space.
But back in 1963, the veteran print journalist turned TV anchor was just starting to see the news media transform itself from a world of brash pencil pushers to blow-dried charmers or screamers, of which he despaired. Cronkite, who died last week at age 92, talked about his career, his critique, and his memoir, A Reporter's Life, on Newsweek On Air in December 1996. My co-host, then Warren Levinson of AP, began by asking what got him into journalism.
magazine article, as a matter of fact, in a magazine called American Boy, back obviously quite a few years ago when I was an American boy. And they were running a series of short stories which were meant as sort of career guidance. And the short story about the newspaper man was the one that grabbed my attention more than all the others. I think that was the first indication that I might become a newspaper person, a press person, a writer, a reporter. It, however, coincided very nicely with my entering high school with the great good fortune of having a journalism course there taught by an editor on his spare time. And he was an inspiration indeed, a guy named Fred Burney. The two of those things together just propelled me into the business, and I've never had a regret since.
As a high school journalist and a cub reporter for United Press myself, I dreamed about being city editor of the World Telegram and Sun in New York, now long dead, and fortunately I never made it. What was your goal at the start, and when did you realize that you were going to go a lot further?
I think that my goal was to be managing editor of a good competitive newspaper somewhere in the country. The bigger the city, the better, so I probably was dreaming of New York, maybe the World Telegram, since my early stages were on the Houston Press. We would have been competing for the job.
Oh, dear. Yeah. You call your book A Reporter's Life, and yet the way most of us know you is those years as an anchorman at CBS. I mean, tell me about the difference between them.
Well, you know, I think that if I brought any strength to television news and an evening news program, it probably was the newspaper experience. I don't think that as you put together an evening news broadcast, there should be very much difference between that and being managing editor of a newspaper. As a matter of fact, I wanted the title of managing editor when I went to the evening news, and it got copied a lot around the country after that. In a more meaningless form, I think. In my case, I really was the managing editor. We plotted out the day's news, the format, what we're going to do that day, and where we should put our strength in correspondence, what we expected in for our edition, our final edition, which was our only edition. I wrote up those pieces that I felt it was necessary that I write or that I wanted to do a little bit differently than our writers, who were very good on our broadcast, did them. So it was very much the same kind of a job as being a managing editor of a paper. We, of course, had to write for the ear instead of the eye, and we were basically a pictorial medium in television, but it wasn't that far different from being a managing editor on a fast-breaking daily paper.
But as the guy in front of the camera, didn't you also have to be a good actor? I mean, I don't know where you look at when you, what you think of when you hear that phrase, the most trusted man in America.
Well, as I keep saying, they didn't pull my wife and that. Sure, it's a little different being on camera than simply being a managing editor, although I've known a lot of managing editors I think had a little ham in them. They acted like they were appearing on the stage and front page. But I guess it takes probably a little ham. But I believe the most successful anchor people and news broadcasters are those who aren't concerned about appearances, aren't attempting to perform, but are really desperately attempting to be understood as they deliver the news.
You say at the end of your book that you don't feel you made a difference, that the successful career is looking back and saying you made a difference, at least in terms of the standards and practices of broadcast journalism. But the whole nation thought you helped it through the JFK assassination. Lyndon Johnson saw your report on the Tet Offensive in Vietnam as proof of vanishing public support. You helped focus serious attention on the Watergate scandal that led to the only resignation of a president. Off-screen in speeches and interviews, you helped start a backfire against Vice President Spiro Agnew's media bashing in the 70s. Isn't that making a difference?
Well, I think that sort of thing probably made a difference. I didn't state myself very well in the book. I think probably it's been picked up by some of my friends that lead into the last chapter. I meant that to apply to the rest of that chapter, which was primarily a discussion of television news. And I was afraid that what I was trying to say was I was afraid that some standards that I think we sat down in the early stages of television news broadcasting have sort of gone by the wayside in recent years. And that's where I meant to say I felt that maybe we didn't make a difference after all.
Do you think there's any chance of those standards coming back, given the kind of competitive pressures that you didn't have to be faced in the era before everybody could get 50 or 60 channels?
That's right. We were very fortunate in my day, those of us who were participating in the three networks, in that competition was severe between us, but we didn't have all of the divertisements that the people have today with all the cable channels and other things to go to, like Internet, for instance, today, which probably makes some difference. But with the situation we had, as competitive as we were, we all were sort of concentrating on doing the news. We understood the limitations of the half hour that we had to deal with, and we spent those 21 minutes that were left to us in the news hole after advertising and ins and outs and all were deducted, a very small amount of time to try to cover such a complicated world and a complex nation as our own. There's no time for the feature treatment that the network programs are giving today. Internet attempt clearly to compete in a narrowing market, but at the same time, I regret that they aren't paying attention to more news and less feature.
Is it hard to avoid watching the news now without a hypothetical red pencil stewing over how you would do it better?
It's very hard. I sit there, I flip around to the three networks, and I'm constantly dictating a note to them in my mind as to what ought to be done, what shouldn't be done.
Walter Cronkite on the December 8th, 1996 broadcast of Newsweek on Air, almost 40 years to the day since anchoring man's first moon landing, literally the high point of his career. Cronkite died at home in New York after a long illness, with family at his side, but little reason to feel better about the news. The tributes began immediately, and as Cronkite would say, that's the way it is.
Cronkite on Cronkite from our July 19th, 2009 and December 8th, 1996 broadcast. And his legacy continues, in journalism education perhaps more forcefully than in TV news, where attitude and amplitude often still rule. A few years after his retirement, Cronkite agreed to have the journalism school at Arizona State University named after him, and he kept in touch with students and faculty. Last week, Cronkite students took first place in the Regional Society of Professional Journalists Mark of Excellence competition. In March, Cronkite student Jack Heiberger was one of nine winners in the Roy W. Howard National Collegiate Reporting Competition. I'm Kaimana Larson. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, with Cronkite and Wallace in mind, Barbara Cook again, and an anthem for life and legacy.
It's not where you start, it's where you finish. It's not how you go, it's how you land. 100-to-1 shot, they call him a klutz. Can outrun the favorite, all he needs is the guts. Your final return will not diminish. You can be the cream of the crop. It's not where you start, it's where you finish. If you start at the top, you're certain to drop. You got to watch your time. Better begin by climbing off the ladder. If you're going to last, you can't make it fast, man. Nobody starts a winner. Give me a slow beginner. Easy does it. Conserve your fine endurance. Easy does it. For that's your life insurance. While you are young, take it wrong after wrong after wrong. It's where you finish. It's not how you go,
it's how you land. 100-to-1 shot, they call him a klutz. Can't outrun the favorite, all he needs is the guts. Your final return will not diminish. And you can be the cream of the crop. It's not where you start, it's where you finish. And you're gonna finish on top. Your final return will not diminish. And you can be the cream of the crop. It's not where you start, it's where you finish. You're gonna finish on top. It's not where you start, it's where you finish. It's not where you start, it's where you finish. It's not where you start, it's where you finish.